out of nowhere, Chaplin shoves the knife in, picks up 50 beans.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, shows, and music from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Jeremy Scott.
This is Recotopia episode 59. I'm Chris Atkinson.
I'm Jeremy Scott.
And once again, would like to acknowledge the chat out there. People are coming out here to watch us on a Tuesday do this podcast. Today's big recommend is a twofer. Got two shorts. The Immigrant from 1917 and A Dog's Life from 1918, Charles Chaplin shorts. Be interesting to talk about those. That's going to make this a different podcast already. How you doing today, Jeremy?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to get a little bit of restedness back after the events of Sin Week.
Yeah.
I'm excited for this conversation. I had never seen either of these shorts that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah.
And it should be a fun, lively discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty-bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small, it's tiny, it's petite, it's wee.
I do, and for those who prefer our recommends to be movies, I apologize up front, because again, last week was Sin Week, and I was here and there, everywhere, and I think I totaled up that I drove about 500 miles in 4 days, even though it was all just in and around Nashville and back home.
Mm-hmm.
So I have not seen a lot of movies, and I've already recommended most of the stuff I saw before that period. So my two recommends are not movies, but I hope you will enjoy them. The first one is a game that we played at a small pre-Sins event with some of the attendees called Chameleon. And I noticed you were playing, looked like some sort of Blockbuster video-based trivia, movie trivia game or something.
Yeah, it was like, it was mostly just kind of your partner gives you a clue and then you have to guess what the movie is from that clue.
Ooh.
And there's four different categories. One's like from a, you say something like a quote from it. It can be a fake quote if it needs to be. One is that you act it out. One is, you know, there's all those different kinds of things. Anyway.
All right. Well, I played Giant Jenga, which was wicked fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went around and played this Chameleon game the rest of the time through. And I found it incredibly fun. I'm going to try and describe it to you. Basically, they have these topic cards, like science fiction. And on there, there'll be, I don't know, 16, 24 different examples. Alien, The Martian, Star Wars, et cetera, right? And then everyone is given a card. And everyone but one person's card has this grid on it, like letters across, numbers down. And that will give you a letter and a number. And then, I'm sorry, this sounds complicated at first. One person's card says, you are the chameleon. All right? And so then everyone does their little George at the vending machine, lines up after you roll the dice, the letter and number, and you find out, let's say it's B4. So you look at the topic card, and it says B4, you go down to that, and let's say it's Jurassic Park. So then what happens next is everyone goes around in a circle and you say something, a single word, that describes that movie. But you don't want to be too specific and you don't want to be too vague, because at the end, everyone's going to point to who they think is the chameleon, because the chameleon does not know which movie on this card everyone's talking about. He didn't get the grid. He only got a card that said, you are the chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has to try and make up a word that might fit for any of the movies on the card, or go by what the other people are saying and try and blend in. So, for instance, one was countries, and Australia was the answer, but one of the guys who was the chameleon put mountains as his response,
mm-hmm.
and all of us pointed to him at the end because Australia is not really known for mountains.
Right.
And he was just guessing based on what everybody else said. So if you pick the correct chameleon, he gets a chance to look at the card and guess which one you were talking about. And if he's right, he wins the round. There's no points or prizes.
Okay.
If you pick the wrong person as the chameleon, then the chameleon wins the round and everybody else loses that round.
Okay.
And then you go again. And as you play and people kind of get the idea, it starts getting trickier and trickier to know who the chameleon is because everyone's getting really good at using words that do describe the movie but are also pretty vague.
Yeah.
And so I bought it. I already have it. It came like 2 days ago. I loved it so much, and I'm going to play it with my family or anytime I have people over. Really simple concept that provided a lot of great fun. I think everybody there said they really enjoyed playing it. So that's what I recommend. If you've never played this game, is check it out.
That does sound fun. That does sound like a lot of fun. I wasn't big on the blockbuster game, but Slab is saying in the chat it might be better with a big group of people to play that. We had four, so it was two teams of two, and so it was... It had some good stuff to it, but it maybe not got the full effect of that. That chameleon sounds really fun.
It was really, really fun.
I also didn't really watch anything over the past week, but I'm drawing from my well of movies that I watched just before our Best of 2022 episode and everything. And the last one that I saw, I watched 12 movies in 3 days. Okay. There was a period of time there where it was just like bang, 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 bang. It was like all day watching movies and getting four or five in one day sometimes. The last one that I watched, before we did the podcast was Argentina 1985, which was up for Best international film. It lost All Quiet on the Western Front, but this one, I would not have been unhappy if it had won. I don't know everything about the politics of Argentina back in the 1980s. I'm worse than the average American on that. Sorry, guys. but I do know that there was a brutal regime that was in power up until 1983, and then a democratically elected president came in with the promise that he would punish all the people who committed outright atrocities while they were in power. And so the movie's plot centers around a district attorney who's going to be willing to go up against the former power of this country, which still has a lot of popular sentiment amongst the people in this movie. So it's hard to find somebody who's willing to prosecute, get a team who's willing to help you out, and to get people who are sympathetic. You know, get a judge maybe that's going to hear your case fairly. Even though the new guy's in, you still have a lot of people who are sympathetic to the old regime. And so a lot of the movie focuses on this guy trying to find people who actually went to prison for whatever reason during this period of time before 1985. And tell them of the atrocities that happened while they were in prison under the name of they were terrorists or whatever. And of course, when you are out searching for terrorists or anybody that you think might be against you, or maybe you're not even looking at that anymore, you're just like throwing people in jail for no reason, the power that you have at that point is usually going to be pretty corrupt. And there are some harrowing stories people are telling on the stand of, like, you know, women who came in to prison who got raped repeatedly, people who lost their family. There were people who were just disappeared, never found them again type of stories going on. And there's still, even with all this, there's still a lot of wonder of whether or not they'll be able to put these guys in prison. And these people who are being prosecuted are like big time, like, generals and people who were in the government and people who were, like, you know, once at a high lofty position that still have a lot of power. Watching this is in when you strip it down, it's just a very intense courtroom drama, but it's got a lot of humor in it too. It's a really, really fascinating movie. I can't remember where I saw it. I think it was on Amazon I saw this movie, on Prime. I think it was free on Prime if you want to watch this. This is a really, really good movie. The guy on the left, by the way, I've seen a couple of Argentinian films, and he was in both of them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so he's definitely one of their major stars, and I unfortunately can't remember his name right now, but Argentina 1985. Jeremy, I know for a fact you'd love this movie. It's long-ish, I guess. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. That's pretty good, but it's well worth your time.
All right. Excellent. I know I heard you talk highly about it when we had the best of the year discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll bump it further up the list. It is on Amazon Prime for a regular subscription, so it's free on Amazon Prime.
Yep.
All right. My second recommend, I did not get through an episode of television that I am sure I will recommend next week when I finish this episode. So my second recommend is also not a movie or a show, and it is something I learned all about for the first time on Sunday morning, and that is drink shrubs. So we went for a brunch, the Sins team, after Sin Week, before everybody drove and flew out of town and, you know, crashed at home and napped for 18 hours. They had 3 mocktails. I don't drink cocktails because I enjoy wine, but I don't enjoy liquor. Neither does my stomach. So for the first time in my life, I thought maybe I'll get a mocktail. And one of them, blackberry, was featured prominently, and I love blackberries. So I just decided to order it. It was called Berry is the New Black, because they give mocktails funny names.
Mm-hmm.
And the recipe there said basil, lemon juice, blackberry, apple cider vinegar, and ginger beer. And yes, Jeremy plus wine is good time. Jeremy plus liquor, much sicker.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Patrick. And this was fucking delicious.
Oh, yeah?
It was fizzy. It was tart. It was blackberry sweet. And I ordered a second one. And halfway through the second one, I got up and went back up to the hostess stand and asked if I could see a menu because I wanted to reread what the ingredients were, thinking I'll make this at home. And she said, "Which one did you get?" And I said, "Berry is the New Black." She goes, "That's the best drink on the menu." And I was like, "Okay, great." And so I raved about it so much that Danae, and this is so like a great insight into her nature, she had just heard me raving about the drink that when the waitress came up, she asked her, "Hey, how did you guys make this drink?" And she said, "Well, I'll go talk to the bartender." So she goes and talks to the bartender and comes back with like the full recipe. But, and here's where we get to the drink shrubs. They use their own shrubs.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, shrubs. Shrub is not a small bush in this instance. It is actually the term for a steeped, infused drink base. So they take apple cider vinegar, blackberries, and basil leaves, and they soak it all together, and then they strain it, and that is their drink shrub, and they use it for more than one drink. And for my drink, they put a little bit of that in the bottom of the glass, then they put like a quarter of a tablespoon of lemon juice and fill the rest of it up with ginger beer, and the potency of that shrub then fills all the rest of that drink up. And so I've already been to 2 stores looking for ingredients to buy to make my own drink shrub, just so I can make this mocktail that doesn't have liquor at home. So I went down a rabbit hole yesterday afternoon on the internet looking up drink shrubs, how to make them. You can pre-buy some. They bottle and sell them. There you go. I had a little bit of a explosion of knowledge, and now I might become a mocktail craft guy at home. I don't know. We'll see.
I didn't have this, and I must have been like in a different world while I was eating, because I didn't hear you talk about this at all. You were sitting right next to me, so I don't know. I didn't even know that this drink was that much of a revelation for you. I will have to take
it. Was.
I will have to drink one of these myself one day.
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is find an excuse to go back to that restaurant.
Oh yeah,
which
yeah,
is
yeah.
Always a good time.
That'll be really hard. That'll be really difficult.
Darn.
Yeah. All right, continuing on going through the well of movies that I watched before our best of. Bill Nye was nominated for an Oscar for the movie Living, which is a it is a remake of Akira Kurosawa's Akira, which is about a bureaucracy in motion, not motion. Basically, it starts off with a bunch of women who want to clear off this one part of the neighborhood for a park. And they've gone to this government building for help to get the all the right, you know, whatever you need, the paperwork to get this thing turned into a park. And you see them at the very beginning. They go to this one department. That department's like, your pitch is amazing. I would say yes to this right now, but you're going to have to go to, and they go and like, you got to go to this other department. So they go to the next department and then they're the same way. Your pitch is amazing, but we can't do this without this department's approval. And then they go to that department and so on and so forth. Finally, of course, you know that they are going to end up right back where they started by the end of it, because nobody can say yes to anything without the other department's approval. And it ends up in this other office by the end of it. I can't remember the exact office that Bill Nye works in, but when the paperwork gets to his office and he realizes that there's nothing they can do with it, it goes into this, like, I don't know, like purgatory pile, basically, where it's like, and somebody's like, well, what are we going to do about this thing? The pitch is perfect or whatever. And it's like, well, it's not our problem now. It's like, there's a recurring phrase that I can't remember where he's like, it'll be okay. Or something like that. Basically like it's fine or something like that. So Bill Nye is running this office and he's very just like, you know, that he commands respect within his office, but he's definitely burned out. He's old. He's done with this. He's got a son who's about to get married to this one woman, but he has just been diagnosed with, I think, cancer, and he doesn't have much longer to live, and he doesn't know how to tell his son about it. But it changes his course trajectory through the movie. And there is a great scene with him and Amy Lou Wood. If you ever watched Sex Education on Netflix, you've seen Amy Lou Wood before. There's a great monologue in there at a restaurant that he has with her. But ultimately, he decides that he is going to make a difference before he dies. And this one particular thing where they're trying to make this park become sort of his mission. And I won't go any farther than that, because you do want to like get the revelations of this movie. It's so well done. I feel like this movie didn't get any kind of play. It got the Oscar nomination for Bill Nye, but I'm wondering how it got an Oscar nomination, because nobody talked about this as far as I know. I mean, maybe Aaron heard a whole bunch of discussion about this movie. I don't know. But I'm surprised. Maybe there was something about it being a remake of such a huge behemoth in movie history that, you know, kept people like, I don't know why that would make a difference. There's been remakes galore that have made a lot of impact. And this one's just really good movie. I think you would love this too, Jeremy. Again, this is another one that I think Bill Nye is fantastic in it. I don't think there was any world in which he was going to win the Oscar in that category, but he's so good. He's so good in it. And, you know, I know that you love him in About Time and stuff like that. This is going to give you that same About Time feel for Bill Nye.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard nothing but good things about this movie and his performance. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely one I hope to catch up to here pretty soon. All right. I think it's time for the big ol' recommend.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
The big recommend is two shorts from the 1910s. The Emigrant from 1917 and A Dog's Life from 1918. But we will, I guess we'll start with the first one. Charles Chaplin was making a bunch of movies for this one studio, before he was able to get creative control himself on all the other stuff that he started making. And so this was one of his last movies that he had to make for a studio. This particular version I saw on HBO Max says that he had like 90,000 feet of film for this movie that ends up being, it depends on when you saw it, I guess, because this one's 25 minutes, but I don't think it got much longer than that, even in its original form. Chaplin spent 4 days and nights in a row without sleep editing it to try to get it complete. I can't even imagine how insane that must have been. But
yeah, geez.
The Immigrant starts off with a bunch of people on a boat, and it has a visual gag of people basically looking like they're all sick, and Chaplin is doubled over the side of the boat looking like he's vomiting, but then he turns around and he's been fishing the whole time. This is a classic Chaplin thing that he does, by the way, where his back is turned to the camera and you think one thing is going on and then he turns around and it's something else. It looks like he gets a fish and then he doesn't even want the fish. He throws the fish into a pile of sleeping people on the deck. And we just see kind of a life there. We see they go in for lunch, and the boat is rocking back and forth. And so Chaplin, somebody gets their bowl first, and the boat is rocking in such a way that the bowl keeps on coming back to him, and he gets his bites as the bowl comes to him, and then it goes away and goes back to the other guy, and then it comes back to him, and he's just eating his food that way. And then there's a big gambling scene, where they're throwing dice, and then one of the guys like loses all of his money in the dice game. And then he goes and steals money from somebody who's a sleeping passenger on the deck. And he goes and they go play a card game after that. And Chaplin's dealing, and somehow he wins that one. I don't know what the whole, I don't even know what they're playing in this thing, but Chaplin ends up taking the dude's money again. But it's this other woman's money, and her daughter notices that her mom doesn't have her money anymore, and she's very distraught about it. And Chaplin, feeling bad, doesn't know that the money he just won is actually hers anyway. Puts a bunch of money in her pocket, and then he's like, well, wait a minute, I might need a couple of dollars. And he goes back into the pocket to get the money, and of course he's spied out by somebody on the boat who accuses him of being a pickpocket as soon as he does that. But then once she gets the money out of her pocket, she's like, oh, this is the money that I've been looking for all along. And I imagine if this were a sound picture, we would be able to sort of enjoy that guy's confusion in the fact that he looked like he was stealing her money, and then she's happy that she has money all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And then they finally make it to the United States. We see the Statue of Liberty, and we have cut farther along into the story, I believe, at this point. It's much farther along. Chaplin is who's playing his classic tramp character he no longer has any money at all. He finds a coin on the floor on the road that he picks up, and it immediately falls back onto the road because he's got a hole in his pocket. And he goes in to eat some food, where they see somebody get beaten up mercilessly because they were 10 cents short on their meal. Chaplin, seeing this, immediately starts fishing around in his pockets and realizes he doesn't have any money to pay for this. It ends up being this weird, this fun little thing where, like, another customer comes in, has the coin that Chaplin found out in the outside, pays for his meal with it, and the guy puts a coin, the waiter puts the coin in his pocket, and it falls to the floor. And there's this whole thing where Chaplin keeps on hiding the coin so that the waiter can't see it, and the waiter keeps on stepping on it accidentally, and Chaplin keeps on trying to reach for it and can't get it, and has to do all this like misdirection, and finally ends up stepping on it and like going down to tie his shoe. And as soon as the waiter turns his head, he picks up the coin and puts it in his pocket or whatever, or puts it in his shirt pocket. I love the whole thing too, where there's this artist who suddenly wants to paint him and the woman. The woman is played by Edna Purviance. She and Chaplin did 30 plus movies together. I mean, they're mostly shorts, but she is in a lot of them. But she's the woman from the boat that he got the money back to. This artist wants to paint them or something and is offering them money. And then Chaplin, who clearly doesn't have enough money to pay for this, dinner that he's gotten, the artist says, I'll pay for your dinner. And as a matter of etiquette, Chaplin is like, no, don't do that. Don't pay for us. Even though he really needs him to pay for the thing. And I think he's hoping that the artist will say, no, I insist, but he never does. So it ends up being that he still doesn't have the money, but the artist says, I'll have my check too, while he's sitting over there with them. And they give him the check and he pays it. And then he comes back and it has some change left. He leaves this big coin for a tip. Chaplin sees the big coin and realizes that it's going to be enough to cover his dinner. So he takes it and puts that on the bill, and the waiter looks at it and is like, "Oh, okay, cool." And then brings back this tiny, tiny coin as the change. And Chaplin's like, "Nah, go ahead. Keep that. That's your tip." And then they leave, and the artist, who thinks that he's tipped, it leaves, and the waiter's like yells at him for not tipping, even though he clearly did and intended to, but Chaplin stole it. And then there's a weird ending where Chaplin force marries the woman at the end.
Yeah.
I don't know what that's all about. That was weird. That was just plain weird. So I don't know what that was all about. I guess that was funny back in 1917. So anyway.
Yeah, it was a little... Listen, there are at least two gags that I think Seinfeld cribbed directly from this. Of course, I think legions of movies and shows have cribbed from Charlie Chaplin's work, but there's a bit in Seinfeld where George is tipping the calzone guy, doesn't get seen tipping.
Yes, yes.
And so he reaches back in to pull it out so he can do it again, but he gets seen pulling out the tips and is accused of stealing. And that reminds me of that moment you're talking about where Chaplin has put the money back in the woman's pocket, and mm-hmm. he's like, I need a little bit for me, and he gets seen doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then again at the end where the artist offers to pay, they go back and forth I think two or three times. He's like, let me pay. He's like, no, let me pay. No.
Mm-hmm.
That's in Seinfeld where George offers to cover the dry cleaning for Susan after Kramer puked on her. She's like, oh, don't worry about it. And he's like, no, I insist. And she's like, okay, it was $17. And he can't believe that she is letting him pay for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like watching this, one thing that I just kept thinking in one of my notes is that there's so much influence here.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much that I've seen other comedies, like when he eats the beans one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much influence in today that, I guess, you know, intellectually comes from these early films,
yeah.
But you don't necessarily make that visual connection until you see it. I laughed for very long in the eating of the beans scene.
Yes.
Strictly because of one facial expression the guy next to him makes.
Yes.
Because he eats these beans solitarily, and the guy is like, he tries to go back to his own food, and he can't. He's like, he's perplexed. It's very weird, and it's very weird. And then out of nowhere, Chaplin shoves the knife in, picks up 50 beans, and puts the whole thing in his mouth, and the dude next to him makes this, oh! Like, I had to rewind it two times to watch it again, because his face is hysterical.
Yes.
At how horrified he is. And this also is something I wanted to say, is that this movie is him, the waiter, and then there's a woman, when we first go into the dining section of the boat, that are all doing almost as great physical comedy as Chaplin himself is doing. That woman that is sliding back and forth across the dining room hall that people are trying to avoid, and then she trips Chaplin. maybe not Chaplin. She trips somebody that comes in. And I was like, man, she's doing dynamic work.
Yes.
And, you know, ultimately, Chaplin gets all the glory. That big waiter was physical comedy, like, personified. I was so impressed with what he was able to do with just the way he carried himself and his face and his body. But that dude next to him, that facial expression is, I'm putting that up there with Matthau's at the end of
Taking a Bellum 1-2-3.
Facial expressions in movies, Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Because he's like just really kind of perplexed, and then he just goes from, whoa! His horrified face is amazing.
That is a thing, man. Like these other actors, I especially noticed it in the next one, but like this one, like there's people doing great work here that probably have long been unsung, stuff like that, where they're doing those great expressions or physical comedy or whatever that, you know, they don't get any of that kind of credit, but they're doing a great job supporting Chaplin in this movie for sure. In A Dog's Life, we return to his tramp character. Of course, he does this a million times, this character. This was his first movie that he was able to make outside of the studio system. So he had a complete creative control on this movie. See him this time. He is sleeping out in some sort of like weird fenced area of some sort in a city. And he's obviously very cold. There's a point where like he stuffs a hole in that's inside the fence with like a newspaper, because that's supposed to get like, I guess that's supposed to knock out the draft or something from that's coming from that hole. And he puts his hands in a can, and then he's obviously hungry. A hot dog vendor comes by, and he's got access in this fence to like reach under the fence and grab a hot dog without the hot dog vendor noticing. Of course, as soon as he does that, the law is walking by, he's watching this. And I don't know what it is. Like if I saw this in a modern comedy, I'd be like, you know, why doesn't the cop notice this shit? But like back in this day, for some reason, it works. It works really well. The cop notices it, sees that he did it, and I don't know. He does go after him, I guess. There's a lot of times though where it's clear that Chaplin is the perpetrator of whatever's going on in the scene, and people are just like oblivious to it. But he puts the hot dog back. And the cop chases after him, and there's this fun little thing, like we didn't see this before, because there's a board blocking the bottom of this fence that the cop knocks over. Now Chaplin has a way of rolling back and forth underneath this fence to one side or the other. So the cop first wants to go around into this fenced area to catch him. Chaplin rolls over to the outside. The cop goes over to the outside. Chaplin rolls back inside. And it just keeps going back and forth. And then finally he just runs away. Then there's a point where we see this. we see this dog that is running around in the streets. Now, that may be a little bit further along, but there's a point where the dog's running around in the streets. There's a bunch of other dogs running around, and he saves this one dog from all these other dogs. And they're calling him Scraps in this. He has this dog, and he wants to go to this bar called the Green Lantern. It's called the Green Lantern. And I looked to see if Green Lantern had any of its basis of its name in this movie, and I couldn't find anything that said that. But, I guess Green Lantern is a common enough thing that you could come up with that on your own, but I thought that was really interesting that the bar was called the Green Lantern. But he goes to this bar, and of course there's a big sign out there that says no dogs allowed. So he stuffs the dog down in his pants, and there's a tail hanging out. So when he walks in to the bar, it looks like he's got a tail and it's wagging. Everybody who sees him turns around and sees Chaplin walking in with this tail wagging behind him. And then he sits down and the tail starts hitting the drum, and it's like, you can hear the drum thumping. And we see some entertainment. One woman is getting all the accolades because she comes out and dances, and it's all upbeat and exciting and everything. But then, another woman comes out, played by Edna Purviance again, who sings a really sad song. And this is the first time I remember something being... I'm not an expert of movies that came out in the 1910s and things like that, but there is some tremendous, like Naked Gun and, you know, stuff that got later on got inspired by this movie. I think the over exaggerated tears that are coming out of this one woman's face while Edna Purviance sings this song is hilarious, because it's just streaming in this two streams, and then by the end of it, there's the joke is she I think she slams her head up on a water bottle of some sort, and it sprays this dude full of water. The bartender ends up seeing that there's a dog in there, and he kicks Chaplin out along with the dog. We go back into the bar, and we see that Edna Purviance is not looked upon favorably by bar management, because she's not bringing in she's not bringing in the clients like she should. And then there's a little thing that says, if you give them a wink, they'll buy a drink. And, so basically saying you need to smile more, back in 1918. And one of the Chaplin goes back into the bar, and, or is he still in? He may be still in at this point. He's still in the bar at this point. And he goes up to the woman, and this one oddly may have been my biggest laugh. The way she winks at him, and there's this odd expression on her face, like she doesn't know what she's really doing, and she does this wink, and Chaplin goes over to try to like wipe something off for her, and she's like, no, I'm flirting. And he's like, oh, okay, cool, you know. And So yeah, I think this is where he gets kicked out, and when he gets kicked out, he goes back to his little place where he is, where he's been sleeping this whole time. Just before he gets there, though, a mugger of some sort, with a partner, steals this money in this big, huge billfold of some sort, and buries it in that yard, and puts it in this hole. And so Chaplin comes back to this part of the yard, and he uses his dog as a pillow. And from what I understand, they plied this dog with whiskey to make it look so that he would look so lifeless on the ground, so that he could use him as this pillow, because he's moving the dog wherever he wants to on this. And from what I understand, this dog wasn't like a big trained dog or anything either. But he's resting on him. And the next morning, the dog is digging and he's found the money. And now Chaplin's like, now we got to go back to the Green Lantern because I've got money. And so they go back. He brings the woman who's just been fired from the job into the bar. They're going to have a good time. But then the muggers are also at the bar and they see that he's got the billfold, and they hit him over the head. Bartender kicks Chaplin out again. And Chaplin now needs to find a way to get back in there to get the money, so on and so forth. So he goes back into those little areas that I've only seen back in the day, like in these 1910s, 1920s. Like, there's a special VIP section type of thing that's like a little bit elevated above the rest of the bar, I guess. And he goes over and he hits this guy over the head. Now, talk about a guy who's doing a really good job. The guy who is the guy who's just there and unconscious the whole time is just like, is amazing to me. Chaplin does what we now know is an old trick of like putting your hands through somebody else's shoulders and like pretending like your hands are their hands. And so he's with this buddy, and the buddy's sitting there like, okay, pulls out his money and everything, and Chaplin's doing all this stuff with his hands and everything, pointing over here and there, and they're like, let's have a drink. And like they have a drink, and he's like putting the glass up to the unconscious dude's face, and then when the other guy's not looking, he goes and gets a drink himself and then puts it back in. And and eventually he's like, all right, come here, and he's like, come closer, and Chaplin hits him over the head with a bottle and he knocks both of them out. He gets the money back, and then there's a big chase that ensues. And this is a thing that I love too, because this is, I think we've always talked about how Jackie Chan seems to be inspired by Charlie Chaplin, by certain things that happen in Chaplin movies. There's a couple of moments in here where Chaplin runs towards this vendor stand of some sort, and just kind of like jumps and then like gets his body straight like a plank, and then falls into the stand. Like it feels like it's a really intricate kind of stunt for him to be doing. And he jumps into there, and there's like this big chase going on. The dog comes in and tries to save the day. And, now I'm trying to remember what else we're going, what else is happening here. Help me out. I can't remember.
The thieves get arrested and Charlie gets away.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sausage vendor in this short that just gets absolutely fucked over by everyone.
Yeah.
And because Charlie's dog steals a sausage from him early on, Charlie steals and gives it to the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this whole sequence where every time the guy turns his back, Charlie steals another cake and
yes,
shoves it in his mouth.
That's one of the best parts of the whole movie.
It is. And I want to know what those cakes were made of, because he's not a large man and he downs like 12 of those fucking things. It's a very humorous scene, but that he's basically robbing the shit out of this guy. And
mm-hmm.
Later on, the chase with the crooks and the cops, and Charlie gets back to this sausage vendor, and the cops start shooting.
Mm-hmm.
The guy's place gets shot all to hell. And when the cops, when the bad guys come in there to get Charlie, he pops over the front and the cops come around behind and they arrest the two thieves and Charlie runs away.
Yeah. And by the end of it, the story that he's told Edna Purviance at this point, you know, like they told him like, you know, one day we can get a plot of land and blah, blah, blah. And so that's what happens there. He's on a plot of land at the end of it, planting seeds. And he goes into his adoring wife at the end. They have a crib, but it's the dog that has had puppies, which is weird because the dog is a boy dog. But anyway, it doesn't matter. They have the dog has puppies at the end. And it is a happy ending for them. But yes, I love that that thing that when he's eating all that stuff that's on that plate, because
even starts to kind of like try and like turn around and catch him. Like he turns his back and then immediately turns around and Charlie's like, well, just dusting it off.
Right. And then, like, I'm just trying to hit this bug that's here and all that. But like I think about how the timing of this is, It's funny, yes. It's really funny that he's stealing these things when the guy is not looking. But I sit there and I think about the timing has to be perfect or the joke doesn't work. If he turns around and sees him at all grabbing or his hand moving away or chewing, if he sees him doing any of those things, then the joke doesn't work. And I've seen so many instances over the years in cartoons and in movies where like the timing is not right. They should see this happening in front of them and then they just pretend like they don't. It feels like to me Chaplin was very big on timing, and it makes the bit so much better because every time that guy is just at the right point, Chaplin stops doing whatever he's doing and pretends like he's just standing there the whole time. And I love that part of the
That again in another sequence in this movie I love at the unemployment office where everybody wants to get nobody wants the job in the sewers, but then they post a job for everybody, races in there, and Charlie's the first one in, but he keeps getting screwed over by people knocking him off the bench. But then one window opens, and Charlie goes to go to that window, but somebody races by him and beats it to him. Then a second window opens, and for about 2 or 3 minutes, he keeps getting beat to open windows by everyone else in the employment office, and then they shut them and close before he gets a job. And that is all about timing.
Yes.
His timing, but again, all the other performers in that scene had to have perfect timing as well, or the joke doesn't work.
Yeah, you have to make it. Chaplin has to be like, you're sitting there going, why don't you just the way they set up the bit is you can't just be standing there at the window. You have to have your number called or whatever. So he can't just be there already. He has to go back and wait every single time. And every time somebody comes out with a number, he gets beat to the punch. And so when someone else comes out with a number or comes out with a job thing, he turns, has to realize it, and then somebody comes racing past him before he can act on it each time. It's kind of amazing looking at this. We don't see this kind of timing on these kind of things anymore, really. Like I said, a lot of times they just leave you up to say, hey, you need to just pretend like this is like they didn't see it the whole time. So, anyway, I hope that you guys enjoyed those two shorts. I think you enjoyed them, right, Jeremy?
I absolutely enjoyed them for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a million of these and there's he does a lot of inventive stuff in a lot of these things. So it's a lot of fun watching these things. Okay. Now we did not discuss beforehand how you would make a double feature for this. By rule, I already have made a double feature for these movies, but you may have a double feature that turns into a triple feature, or you may have two movies that go with these two movies. I will be interested to see where you go on this.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right, so I made two rules for myself right out of the gate when you announced these picks. Mm-hmm. That I was not going to be beholden to a silent film pick, and I was not going to be beholden to a short.
Mm-hmm.
That I wanted to try and get a tonal, if not also some story beats match. So again, I was never going to pick Buster Keaton for this stuff. I was never going to pick any other shorts. I did briefly go through some other slapstick, like Mr. Bean was an option for a hot minute. Mm-hmm. I think that would be a good match. And I'm going to give you what I think my runner-up and my top are both excellent picks, but I have good reasons for why I made my ultimate choice. The runner-up, the one that was the leader in the clubhouse for days, was the Wallace and Gromit shorts. A grand day out, the wrong trousers, and a close shave.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of slapstick, clay, physical comedy. But again, tonally, Wallace and Gromit are fairly harmless, if not noble. Mm-hmm. Whereas at least the character in A Dog's Life that Chaplin plays is not entirely a good person. It's not a terrible guy. He's a homeless person who probably needs money and would love to buy a farm and get married with a woman. But, you know, he steals all that food from the vendor, mm-hmm. and he goes pretty hard after stolen money that was never really his.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got an animal that is helping or sometimes hindering him. And there's a pretty girl he likes. And so my pick is Mouse Hunt.
Ooh, Mouse Hunt.
Which has Nathan Lane and Lee...
Evans. Yep.
And it is a slapstick comedy that is inspired by a lot of silent era and 40s and 50s era comedies. It's about two brothers who have inherited this dilapidated but huge mansion. And for selfish reasons, they want to renovate it and auction it off. But there's a mouse. And the mouse starts off as a nuisance. Let's get this mouse. And the mouse is way smarter than them. And so they just keep escalating their attempts. They bring in Christopher Walken as an exterminator. They get the cat from hell to try and get the mouse out. They put mouse traps all over the giant kitchen floor, and knowing that the mouse will have to step on one of them, but he doesn't. There are two girls that they are enamored with that they're trying to impress and win over. Everything falls to pieces by the end, and then in a simple twist of fate, everything goes right for them because the mouse that inherited this from a string factory magnate. And the mouse drops some cheese into the string making machinery, and they turn into string cheese magnates and become wealthy and get the women that they love. And I just feel like this would be a really, really good, fun compliment as a modern sort of answer to these two shorts. So Mouse Hunt is my answer.
I haven't seen Mouse Hunt since it came out. The one thing that I remember about this was we had this at my old theater that I worked at. And it was one of the busiest days that I remember working at that theater. That theater didn't do like slam bang business or anything, but that was there was a weekend where we had Titanic, Tomorrow Never Dies, Scream 2, Good Will Hunting.
Oh, Jesus.
All those movies were playing all at once. And I remember Mouse Hunt even selling out that day. I think people turned away by other movies, went on to see that one and whatever. But I haven't seen it since 1997. So I need to have to take a look at that one again, give that one another look. So
it was, I had such big expectations for DreamWorks. And this is one of the first handful of movies DreamWorks put out.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw it in theaters, I was not super impressed with it, just like with The Peacemaker. A lot of early DreamWorks films were sketchy.
Yeah.
But I have seen it a couple times since then, and I find it really funny now. Like, if I just sort of go in knowing what it is, I can have a lot of laughs. I just thought it was a good match here for several reasons.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Next week's homework?
All right. Everybody might have heard Chris say he's doing a thing. He's starting back in the 10s and he's doing comedies, and I think he's gonna either jump around or move forward through decades. I'm not doing a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just making a weekly pick, and
yep.
I want us to go revisit 1998's Ronin.
Ooh.
An action thriller.
You got De Niro on the brain, man.
I got, well, De Niro, and then this is a David Mamet screenplay, and Mamet has made a lot of appearances on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Not personally, he doesn't make personal appearances,
right?
And I will tell you that this is a movie about a mysterious woman from Ireland who hires a bunch of basically Ronin, excommunicated intelligence officers from around the world. De Niro plays a former CIA guy. And Sean Bean is in this movie, Jean Renault, Natasha Meckelhorn, I don't know how to say her name, Stellan Skarsgård, Katerina Witt. Plays a Russian skater. Big stretch.
Yeah.
And they're brought together to steal this mysterious case. And then things start going awry. And double crosses happen. And as Patrick is stating, it has some incredible car chases. Some of the best, I think, of the modern era, even though that's like 25 years ago now.
Yeah.
But I have not seen Ronin in probably 5 or 6 years. I remember the last time I watched it thinking it was really, really good. And I can't wait to go back and visit again. You can see it for free on Pluto TV, Tubi, and the Roku channel. And you can also watch it for free on Amazon Prime if you have a regular level subscription. And Google says it's on YouTube even for free. Hmm. So lots of places to try and find Ronin.
I haven't seen this since it came out. I remember the car chase in it. Is this, were you at Hollywood 27 when Tom Hanks came and saw this movie? He was shooting The Green Mile at the time because there was a story that people had at Hollywood 27 that Tom Hanks came and saw this movie while he was filming The Green Mile. So
yeah, I was not there because I didn't start until I think March of 1989.
Yeah, yeah. So that was an interesting little thing that happened when they were shooting The Green Mile in Nashville. People started seeing these celebrities popping up at Hollywood 27. Anyway, all right, that should be interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I think that's going to be it for this episode. Once again, thank you, chat, for coming out and talking during this. You guys make us a lot better, I believe. Didn't have questions to throw around, but we'll be doing that again, I'm sure. And yes, I'm doing a thing. I'm glad that Jeremy's not doing a thing because it's just what we want to do, and that's the type of that's what I love about it. I'm going to be going in order on the decades. I'm going to be 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. Even 60s slab. Yeah, I'm going to be getting the 60s in there. But thank you guys so much. Next week is Ronin. We'll see you next time.
See you guys.
See ya.
Goodbye.
Bye. Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
Join the stream, Yardlink. Join the stream, Yardlink. Jeremy. So, I have an update.
Yeah.
My wife and I were driving to lunch Monday or Tuesday of last week. And in front of us, there was a car with a new Tennessee license plate that did not contain a beep.
Ooh.
And my wife can attest, it broke me. Like, for at least a mile of driving, I just had this utterly befuddled face because, as I ultimately said out loud, this flies in the face of weeks worth of data. Thousands of plates I've seen that all had a B, and now here's one out in the wild that doesn't, and it's from my county. And
This is going to ruin my fucking idea before it's even over. Because we got these new plates last year, right?
Yes.
Okay. So it's not this year. It's not a thing where, like, you saw the January, February, March plates and they had B's on them, and now suddenly they've introduced the April plates and there's different letters or whatever. So,
right.
Did you see the county?
Yeah, it was my county.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, man. I'm telling you, it's as I passed this vehicle ultimately, because I wanted my lunch more than they apparently wanted theirs.
That's true.
My windows were up, but I still shouted out as I went by, "Where did you get that license plate?"
Yeah.
Because
why do you always wear this
absolutely.
Same dress? You can't break up with the phone. Why do you always wear this same dress?
That's one of my very favorite Seinfeld moments.
Yes. I love, by the way, throughout that entire series, how indifferent Jerry is to being broken up with or breaking up with some. He's usually the one getting broken up with because of something that they did, but he's so indifferent about it. There's never like a moment where he's like, "I really like that girl," you know, because that's what that show was always about. Like, never ever have any dramatic moments whatsoever.
Yeah.
No learning.
Yeah.
You know.
The best is that episode where George is up and Elaine is down, and Jerry realizes he's even Steven.
Mm-hmm.
And Elaine says, "Give me $20." And she does, and she crumples it and throws it out the window. And then later in the episode, he finds a $20 bill in his jacket, mm-hmm. and they're both like, oh. Mm-hmm. But this girl breaks up with him at the end of the episode, and he's like, "It's okay." She's like, "What?" He's like, "No, it's all right. You know, like, things have a way of working out for me.
Yeah.
You know, have fun dating you. Good luck in your life."
Right. Yeah. My favorite all time response back is that one where the one woman he's dating, like, is like, "I can't go out with someone that I don't respect." And he's like, "You're a cashier."
So funny. She didn't like his act, yeah. So she dumps him.
"You're a cashier."
That would suck, though. Like, if you fell in love with a stand-up comedian, mm-hmm. before you ever saw their act,
then
you saw their act and it was terrible,
mm-hmm.
that would be tough.
That would be tough
to deliver that news.
Although it happens all the time, from what I understand, like, that type of thing. Like, Kevin Smith is always talking about how, like his wife is definitely not a Kevin Smith fan, you know? Like, she knows. No, she loves me and everything, but she doesn't like any of the movies I put out, you know, that type of thing.
She's even in one of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, but you and I have spent so many years recommending movies to people, and, you know, it's not always like, "Oh, I loved it," and, you know, like, that's how I learned my wife's taste, is by recommending movies to her. I showed her Training Day when we were dating.
Yeah.
Jesus, that was a bad move, but I didn't know.
Yeah.
I would never show her that movie today.
Right, right. It's only when, but, that's one of those things where you want to strangle younger you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I'm really curious to see what this Ben Affleck, Matt Damon artist Equity studio does,
because mm-hmm.
their whole thing is they're going to distribute the returns of the movie amongst all the crew in addition to the cast.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, if you are part of creating something successful, you will receive more money. Like, I don't think the Grip gets residuals.
No.
But in this instance, they will get a return. And so the theory is that everyone will want to do a really good job and will draw in the best talent with them to try and create greatness. So they want to do A24 quality, but in a way that basically puts equity in everybody that works on the film. And I'm sure it's, you know, stair-step depending on what level you are.
Yeah.
But imagine being a Grip going, "So I can work for this Paramount film and get a paycheck, or I can work for this Artist Equity project and get probably the same paycheck and then a bonus if the movie's profitable."
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to take that.
Yeah, that's an interesting little experiment. I'd like to see how that works out.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly danger, crashes and burns. Like, I thought Project Greenlight was an equally interesting experiment
mm-hmm.
that never quite became what it could have been,
yeah.
although the reality show aspect of it was always entertaining.
Here's the problem with Project Greenlight for me. They immediately cut creators off at the kneecaps when they said, "You have $1 million budget and you can't go over it." Now, occasionally they did some concessions here and there, and, like, you know, "I can get you an extra blah, blah, blah." But, like, so they had to not only find a script that they could do for $1 million or less, but they also had to get talent that could work for that paltry
right.
amount, or who would work for it. I'll never forget I can't remember what movie it was, but I do remember the guy coming into the casting office and going, "I was thinking Sean Penn for this." And the casting director was like, "Oh man, I love Sean Penn. You're not getting him."